And we hope that you are, we hope that you will decide to make a contribution in support of this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station.
Listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts exploring the creative bounty of New York from WBAI Radio 99.5 on the FM dial. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. Tonight's show will be joined by filmmakers Stephen Fischler and Joel Suchar to discuss five of their films on American radicalism, including From Swastika to Jim Crow and Red Squad, among the latest streaming releases from Ovid's great collection, Anarchy in the USA. But first, a WBAI fundraising request or beg. Today, we are again asking you to make a tax-deductible contribution to WBAI's very survival by helping us pay the rent on our transmission tower at Four Times Square and our broadcasting studio on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Remember, when renters say, I can't pay the rent,
landlords tie you to the railroad tracks just in time for the oncoming train.
So, too, pay the rent for WBAI. Goodness, yeah, no, yuck, yuck. We live with this fear. To pay the rent for WBAI, the number to call is 212-209-2950 or go online to towerfund@wbai.org or give to number 2, wbai.org and make your tax-deductible contribution to WBAI.
Or, on the other hand, become a BAI buddy.
That's a sustaining member of this unique radio station, crammed with diverse opinion and thought 24 hours a day. What more could you want?
Yeah, no, here's how you do it. You become a BAI buddy by making a monthly donation, as little as $10 or as much as you can, that is painlessly deducted from your bank account or credit card.
And if you donate in the name of your favorite WBAI program, such as Cat Radio Cafe,
or all or any of WBAI's programs, call 212-209-2950 or go online to give2wbai.org.
Now, you know, WBAI has relied on the financial support of its listeners, not corporations or commercials, for over 60 unbelievable years that people have been pouring this money into this radio station.
If there is no listener support, there's no WBAI.
So please chip in.
Keep WBAI signal alive.
We live in lousy times. Let's not make them worse. Remember what the head existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said.
There may be more beautiful times, but this one is ours.
Really? Support WBAI. And now, on tonight's show, we'll be joined by the founders of Pacific Street Films, Stephen Fischler and Joel Suchar, to discuss their docs on American radicalism, including Red Squad, Frame Up, The Imprisonment of Martin Sostre, Anarchism in Free Voices of Labor, Anarchism in America, and From Swastika to Jim Crow, among the latest streaming releases in Ovid's collection, Anarchy in the USA, which you can check out on Ovid.tv. Joel Suchar and Stephen Fischler met at the age of 9 in a rough and tumble, and I'll query how rough, how tumbling this neighborhood was in Brooklyn. They attended Brooklyn Tech, where they deemed themselves anarchists. And I'll ask them if they read Mad. In 1970, at NYU Film School, their student films, I Am Curious Harold and Inciting to Riot, caught attention of their instructor, fortunately, Martin Scorsese, who encouraged them to use film as a political tool. Something of a serious encouragement, I'd say. Prescient of Martin Scorsese. They founded Pacific Street Films, a documentary production company in Brooklyn in 1969. They have produced more than 100 films on subjects as diverse as surveillance, martial arts, animal rights, Hollywood, and anarchism, all from a uniquely personal point of view. The Museum of Modern Art hosted a career retrospective of Pacific Street Films in 2004, and indeed they have accumulated a great deal of renown as documentarians. So you two, I'm so happy to meet you. Your films are incredible and begin at such an early age in your lives, later than nine, though.
Well, we made some really early ones.
Yeah. Well, you did before age nine?
Yeah, well, I had my father's old 8mm regular 8, not Super 8. Did some goofing around with that before we decided to embark on a career, for better or for worse.
Now, as I said, this rough and tumble neighborhood in Brooklyn, it must somehow involve Pacific Street. That is in a pretty good neighborhood now, isn't it? Of Brooklyn?
Pacific Street? No.
And it's still bad, huh?
Yeah, well, rough and tumble meaning, well, we grew up near Sheepshead Bay.
Oh.
It's kind of a rarefied neighborhood. I would say mostly Jews. And in those days, Brooklyn was a series of provincial villages, some Italian, some Irish. And, you know, woe be to the one who wandered into an Italian or an Irish neighborhood,
right?
You always get into fights. So, you know, that's what we meant by rough and tumble.
Okay, actually, I lived in Sheepshead Bay, so
it's
curious. Actually, we lived in a veterans project on Avenue X. Okay. And actually, I met my best friend at the age of 11 in Sheepshead Bay, and we have been, you know.
There you go.
We wrote half a novel. Half a
must
novel.
Must be something together. In the water. It didn't come into play until later. We had made a couple of films. We started sort of as amateur filmmakers. One of the first films we made when we were at NYU, we found a friend named Barry. He had left his jacket in the trunk of Joe's car. And in the pocket of the jacket, we found his draft card. So we made a film called Barry Won't... in which he burned his draft card for him.
He burned his draft card.
We made a film about that. And we went on to make the I Am Curious Harold. And you know, it was really a trip making films. It was a lot of fun. Wow. It was interesting. So we transferred to we both had different majors, but we ended up transferring to the film school. And when we began Pacific Street Films, the film collective, we rented a loft on Pacific Street in Brooklyn, and that's where the Pacific Street name came in. Totally different neighborhood than where we grew up.
Yeah, which would have been what? Voorhees Avenue.
Yeah, you know, the King's Highway or something.
Right. That Shoulder Street. Emmons Avenue.
You mentioned something about Atlantic Avenue. Is that where you're broadcasting from?
No, we're not broadcasting from Atlantic Avenue, but that's where the recording studio is, studio is, not the recording.
Is it near the old X-Lax factory? I love that place.
I don't know. We should renovate that.
No, that was a big thing, X-Lax back then on Atlantic Avenue.
We were in the downtown Brooklyn area, one block off of Atlantic Avenue.
I see. That's right. That's why it seemed so familiar.
Our loft was between Court and Clinton, so we were sort of on the bay side of Cobble Hill. That's a divided line.
Right. Not a bad. It's what it is. It's not Sheepshead Bay. It doesn't have swans in the water.
Pacific Street back then, it was affordable. I mean, I remember we had to move out of the loft because our old Irish raised the rent. I think, what was it, Steve, from like
he raised it from 300 to 350 for a 2,500 square foot loft. And we said, outrageous. Who's going to pay $350 a month rent?
And we were across the street from, it was a Jewish, what was the name of that?
It was a girls yeshiva. I forget the name.
Girls yeshiva. And now it's high. Now all this stuff, and I mean, it's through the roof in terms of. You know what they cost. In fact, 175 Pacific Street, where we were, I think was one of the. I saw a couple of years ago was one of the highest priced sales.
Oh,
I don't know, a couple mil.
Is it now one of those towers? A big
no, it's still building? It's still the original building, which was a three-story building. There was when we moved in, there was a wood shop, a carpentry shop on the main floor. I think it had been a carriage house in previous years. And our loft was on the second floor, and there was a small apartment on the third floor where, owner of the building lived.
And we were friendly with this guy. Was an old Irish carpenter who told us stories. He remembered when Brooklyn there were wooden sidewalks.
Well,
he was already probably 75 years old when we met him.
What, Brooklyn had no sidewalks? Do you say?
No, it had wooden sidewalks.
Oh, wooden sidewalks, really? How cool, huh? But better than cobblestones, anyway. Cobblestones. Anyway, how?
Frank was Gil Martin was a good guy because when we started making Red Squad, which dealt with the police intelligence gathering by the New York City police and by the FBI, initially, they were on our case, and he told us that the FBI came by and they wanted his permission to search our apartment when we weren't there, and he refused.
Good for him.
They used to pay his visits down at the FBI.
it was
hilarious. You know, that's the window.
Amazing, an amazing movie. But I've had a couple questions before we get to this.
Sure.
I mean, you guys were very young when you were so smart as to cover the Red Squad, and particularly in the way you did. But you decided you were anarchists at the age of 9. What in your background or not so far background, your current life attracted you to anarchism?
Well, for me, unlike Steve, and Steve came from a union background, his parents.
Yeah.
I was born in a DP camp in Germany after the war. So I was born an anti-fascist.
Right.
You know, even though we lived in a tenement neighborhood when my parents came over, and I heard these stories all the time, and they would talk about all this stuff. And I had a whole bunch of other stuff, pictures and everything, including of myself in a DP camp. So I was kind of born an anti-fascist.
Right.
And it was only after I met Steve in high school did we actually become conscious anarchists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe I'm speaking for both of us, but I think the whole concept of anarchism really developed when we were in Brooklyn Tech, which was, of course, it was a good high school, but at the time it was 6,000 boys, so it was a kind of a wild scene.
It wasn't a good high school. What are you talking about, a good high school?
It was considered a great high school, wasn't it? Like one of the top, music and art or science.
10% of the student body were kind of student police officers that would line the hallway.
Yeah.
And there was the whole issue of discipline. The imposition of that kind of authority really spurred an awareness and appreciation for anti-authoritarianism.
Mm.
And you don't get more anti-authoritarian than anarchism, and
that's right.
That's where those thoughts appeared.
Well, we were both considered discipline problems. I was, however, in my case, that was an incident where we kind of did a lot of crazy stuff. I got thrown out of Brooklyn Tech, and I had to spend a semester in Madison High School.
Oh, I went there, right? Oh, so we really come from the same place.
But the problem with Madison High School was it was so unlike Tech. We used all boys. You didn't have to do anything to kind of put on airs.
Right, you had a cheerlead.
I got so disgusted with Madison High School. I said, I got to do well because I got to get back into Tech, which I did. So I graduated from Brooklyn Tech.
And you didn't go to Madison, did you, Steve?
I did not. I would have, but I wasn't selected to be thrown out of high school the way Joe was.
Well, in Madison, they had stuff like freshmen sing. Oh, sophomores sing, too.
Well, what's her name? Did Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all these other luminaries went to Madison?
I think Bernie Sanders and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Bernie Sanders, yes.
Yeah. Right. It's funny, no, but did any famous person go to Brooklyn Tech? I'm sure they got it on the wall.
Yeah, you know who? I got to tell you. You know the MAGA billionaire John Katsimatidis?
Really?
He went to Brooklyn Tech. He graduated a year before us, and he was a member of that service squad, which Steve mentioned.
What, do they have white, kind of
No, they had straps, armbands, something like that.
Sort of a strap apparatus there.
Yeah, little Nazis who wandered around the hall, and if they caught you there, you'd say, I'll go into the bathroom, and say, do you have a pass?
Hall monitors. For one year, I got one of those things, and it did put the SS.
The head of discipline in at the school was, at least they said, was an ex-FBI agent. And
yeah, Mr. Fanning, he was
Fanning. So.
Funny how these memories.
So we went to NYU and we got involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and that's when we started really filming, making more political films, and we noticed that the police were always photographing or shooting movies of the demonstrators. So we started to shoot pictures of them. And, that's how the whole thing really kind of began.
So the Red Squad was your first adult movie, wasn't it?
We had made, before Red Squad, we had made a couple of films at NYU. One was, we went to film schools called I Am Curious Harold. We were part of an anarchist group called Transcendental Students, and we decided, what we're going to do is kind of add joy to the everyday activities of the students. So we took over South Study Hall. We brought in, a band. We brought in wine. It was dope. And then we took the place over. That could create quite a kerfuffle. That was actually a silent film. We added music, but we decided, this film sort of went over well with the student body. Why don't we go to film school? And that's when we transferred to film school. Huh. And we made our first sound film called Inciting to Riot. And we were in Scorsese's a production class when we did that.
Did you notice that he was Martin Scorsese at the time?
No, Martin Scorsese was this little guy with sort of greasy hair. And actually, we have footage of him. We shot 16 millimeter. I had a 16 millimeter Bolex. I should add that the Harvard Film Archives, since 2013, basically they've acquired our entire archive. So everything, most of our archive now is in Harvard, which is great. But we attracted his attention, and he was very helpful to us. And he took this film, Inciting to Riot, over to Italy to this well-known festival, De Popoli. So that kind of started us down that path.
I mean, Inciting to Riot was a kind of somewhat dramatized documentary about Transcendental Students, or TS, the anarchist student organization that we were partners with a bunch of other students in founding. Red Squad, which was probably maybe our first really widely distributed documentary. Yeah. I mean, really, we owe some credit to the New York City Police Department for making the film.
Yeah.
Because when we started to film them, they started to investigate us. And we said, hey, let's film their investigation of us. We'll turn the cameras on them.
And
that's how the film happened. And
so live, you see this transformation happening while the film is rolling. There is this investigation, the investigators being investigated and vice versa. It was written about not long ago in the New Yorker, right?
Yeah, Richard Brody.
Richard Brody wrote about his.
And the funny thing about Richard Brody, he was an intern for us in the 1980s.
Oh, God.
On a couple of films. But the thing about Red Squad, which is amazing when you look at it now, I look at these guys and they're so 1950s. The way they're dressed.
Yeah.
The way they act, as opposed to the kind of super sleuths today you find as, part of the police department. But
they were heavies. They were heavies.
They didn't know how to dress yet.
No. Right. And in fact, J. Edgar Hoover, if you need the history of the FBI, all the agents had to be white. They had to dress a certain way. And that was the dress code for the FBI.
Was which what, also, Right. And White Sox was part of the outfit, I guess, because it was the giveaway, wasn't it?
Most probably, yes.
But we became very adept at spotting undercover cops and the cars that they drove. And we were pretty good, you know, when it came
to had our files on them, which a lot of radical organizations used.
Right.
They had other files. Yes.
They had a lot of names. They weren't called the Red Squad officially, were they? Can you tell a little bit about the background of their name and why it was hard to track them?
Well, I think they began maybe probably in the 19th century. I mean, they were called the Radical Squad because, you know, with the rise of especially in the late 19th century, you know, anarchism, socialism, and then communism. I think they went through name changes. I think the Radical Bureau, Radical Squad.
The Anarchist Squad. They're all these squads. But the Red Squad, of course, is a reference to the threat, the quote unquote threat of communism that they were going to prevent and stop.
Right. Did that all start as early as the Bolshevik Revolution when they had Red Squads here arresting and beating up?
It had a long history.
Mm-hmm.
Our kind of mentor in all this was an old labor lawyer by the name of Frank Donner. Mm-hmm. He was a member of, you know, he represented UE. I remember when they were under, like, you know, scrutiny for being communist.
They were very left. Yeah.
And Donner wrote a series of books about surveillance. And this goes back to the 1960s. And I mean, it's well worth reading. Because he was very prescient in his view of, you know, where this is all heading, which is where we're at now in this country, in this world, you know, global surveillance.
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened when we started making the film is we were subject to harassment by the police. We were followed. The police cars would be parked downstairs by our loft. So we wrote a letter about documenting the harassment we were experiencing, and we mailed a copy of the letter to the editor to every newspaper in New York City. And Nat Hantoff in The Voice picked it up, and he published it as a front page article. He didn't write an article. He said, I just received this letter from filmmakers, and subsequently other letters that we wrote, he published as well. Yeah. And
it became a cause celeb for him.
Once their negative, you know, their harassment generated negative press, they backed off. They backed off a lot.
They did,
I should really just add that we probably are the only group of filmmakers extant that have received a letter from J. Edgar Hoover in regards to, you know, claims that they harassed one of our members, Hallie Black's parents. This was via the... Remember Red Koch when he was congressman?
Sure. He's in the movie.
When he read Hinto's articles, he got so incensed that he shot a letter off to the FBI, which was answered by J. Edgar. So we have that at Harvard now, actually.
Well, what was Mayor Koch? I mean, when he became mayor, what was his position on the various Red Squads?
I think he was less radical than when he represented the West Village.
I think so, too.
He's in the film. You see, we interviewed him.
Yeah.
And after the film was out, a couple of us went to visit him in his office. And we looked like, you know, remember the times, the late 60s, long hair. The minute we walked into his office, he saw us and said, okay, first thing, I don't hate cops. We already knew that his politics were changing.
So that was a scoop on him. You didn't have to do any more on him to know where he was at. Now, let's. I want to play a song here and ask you some more about your attachment to anarchism and your research and how it spread, how your skills and your infatuation with the history of anarchism grew, and how your filmography developed as a result of your, you know, your 9 years old, you had a sense of it already. And now you explain to all the rest of us, what is this thing called anarchism? As Bob Fass used to say, anarchism is not chaos. So,
Bob Fass, huh?
Yeah, sure. He was the
radio unnameable.
Absolutely. The voice of WBAI until only, you know, a couple of years ago, or a year ago, in fact. So this is called, this is from your film, The Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchist. And we'll talk about that film as soon as we hear this and see if it gets everybody in the mood to go take to the streets again.
In all the Klassen, Blumen, Geld, Herzmen, Saba, Stoffkes, Inglach, Leidach, Kind und Cage, Hosen, Pumpe, Bockes.
Inglach, Leidach, Kind und Cage, Hosen, Pumpe, Bockes. Genug schon wieder Horven, genug schon morgen Leien. Mata Sabastoffke, lo mir Brüder sich verteilen.
Mata Sabastoffke, lo mir Brüder sich verteilen. Brüder und Schwester, lo mir den Herren die Hände. Lo mir Nikolai, der Linser brechen die Wände.
Schwester, lo mir gehen zusammen, lo mir Nikolai kennen, begrüßt mit der Mann.
Hey, hey, da neue Polizei, da neue Samen der Scham jetzt, Rasse.
Nächten hat er geführt, hat er gelemisst, meint ist er geworden, hat Kapital.
Fantastic, really. It, you know, there's a commercial on now, and I think it stars Matthew McConaughey. It has a, this white guy, big white guy, leading an army of people, and they all are clapping. It looks remarkably fascistic, but it, do you know the thing I'm talking about? I guess not.
I try to stay away from Matthew McConaughey.
Well, he's on a commercial, which is a little unusual, because I don't think he's an anarchist at all. But it just reminiscent of how that clapping can organize a group of singers in a remarkable way, you know. So talk a little bit about how the Jewish anarchy, the early Jewish anarchists who arrived here in well, I guess they began arriving at the turn of
late 19th century.
Well, late 19th, yeah. So they were early anarchists. They were pre-Bolshevik escapees. I mean, that really wasn't the bulk of the immigration from Russia and Eastern Europe. It was really earlier.
The immigration
earlier.
Was from the late 19th century through maybe the 1920s
right.
In the United States. And,
right.
The anarchist movement, immigrant anarchist movement, which was very important in terms of activism in the trade union movement and generally, with, of course, they were Jewish anarchists, Russian, Spanish, Italian, all right. The different European immigrants that came to the United States.
And in the United States, did they find some kind of community among anarchists, or did it stay kind of segregated into ethnic groups?
I think that there were different, you know, there were different communities within the anarchist movement. There were the Jewish anarchists. Emma Goldman, although Jewish, wasn't really, you know,
she
part
wasn't
of the Jewish anarchist movement. There were Italian anarchists, there were Spanish anarchists, there were Portuguese anarchists. I think they all acted to some degree separately, but they did mingle with one another, you know, book clubs, whatever. So there was organization within these various groups.
And in the film celebrates a paper that an anarchist newspaper that the Stimme. What is the whole name of it?
It's the Freie Arbeit der Stimme, which
Freie Arbeit der Stimme.
The Free Voice of Labor.
Right.
And it published for 90 years in Yiddish. And, you know, it was an important cultural and political institution, certainly in the anarchist movement, but even wider than that. And I think one of the things the film highlights is that what the anarchists who ran the Freie Arbeit der Stimme did is they kind of rescued the Yiddish language, which had been considered more of a peasant language in Europe. If you were an intellectual or radical in Eastern Europe in the turn of the 20th century,
German,
you learned Russian or German. You didn't speak or write in Yiddish. But here, the editors and the people running the Freie Arbeit der Stimme, they helped use Yiddish is a language for political expression, for poetry, for creative writing, and really turned things around. So they had an important, over and above the anarchism, in other ways, they had an important role.
It's fantastic, really. I mean, to follow the years and years of life that they had. You dug up an enormous amount of anarchists, Jewish anarchists, to recall what it was like to have been an anarchist then, the dangers involved. But their sweetness and their literacy shone through in every case, no matter how old they were or how, you know, raggedy they looked. They had this glow about them when they remembered the tenets of anarchism. Talk a little bit about those people, how you captured them on film, and how easy it was to talk to them, and so forth, and who they were to you, if anybody.
Well, the thing I always loved about these people were when you met them, it was like you're talking to your grandmother, but they were not talking about, like, you know, chicken soup. They were talking about fighting the cops. So that was great, you know, and they're really, as you said, you put it quite well in terms of the sweetness. They were great. Yeah. And they were open, and they were kind of, you know, they didn't kind of have this, oh, I don't want to talk about this, I don't want to talk about that. They talked about everything. Mm-hmm. We shot them. And I think a lot of that, I have to give credit to our camerawoman, Judy Airola, who unfortunately passed away 2 years ago. Mm. She just identified with those people, and her shooting really made, you know, the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
They considered us comrades, and from their point of view, if you were a comrade, then you had to be open and welcoming and do what you can. I mean, I will say that in Free Voice of Labor, the first day of filming, we wanted to film there for a while, but they only allowed us in the day that the paper closed.
Yeah.
The reason being is that many of the members on the editorial board were in this country illegally, and they were afraid the attention might jeopardize their social security payments, which they all depended on.
so they grew a little more comfortable in a capitalist environment.
Right, so when the paper was going to close, Arne Thorne, who was the last editor, called us up and said, listen, you guys might as well come down today. It's the last day of the newspaper. And we did. But, you know, we used that as a way to begin a conversation with these people and film, and as you see in the film, you know, really get to know them really well. And I think the one remarkable thing about them was that they didn't just talk about the ideas of anarchism, mutual aid, direct action, and so on. They lived it. They were a community, and they helped one another out. And it was a beautiful thing to see.
You mean, did you know, in personal struggles, they were there for each other.
Absolutely.
They were there as a group for each other so that they could. That was the amazing part, that after all these years, they would still because the personal was not didn't take priority over the political in any way in this group, which is a little surprising. Usually, if you have a contrary opinion, you're out, not here, because that was the purpose of being an anarchist, is you could think what you want.
They were inspirational people, and we were very friendly with them. And it was one of the nice things about making the film was becoming, to a certain extent, part of that community.
Yeah. And what do you suppose was it about you, your curiosity or your curly hippie
curly
hair? Curly locks. What made you attractive to them? Your curiosity
Because we made it clear right off the bat that we were anarchists.
Okay.
And the other thing is, I should mention that we had Paul Avrich, the late Paul Avrich, was probably the premier academic anarchist writer. I mean, Paul died a couple of years ago. But he kind of paved the way for us because Paul actually cultivated the relationships with these people and they trusted him. So when he introduced us to them, you know, we became trusted members of that group. And I think that we were able to get on and get along with them.
They, I'm not recalling it now, but because so many other people in your films did go unjustly to film, to jail, but none of them really were incarcerated for their activities on the street or organizing.
Well,
or were they? I just can't.
If you look at Anarchism in America, we traveled to Mexico, to Cuernavaca, to interview Molly Steinman and Senya Fleshin, who were deported from the United States because of their
activism.
Well, tell me, was Emma Goldman, there's footage of Emma Goldman, quite striking and quite interesting to see how there's almost a British tinge to the way she spoke. She spoke very well and very powerfully. You got to see it just to, if you're Emma Goldman fans, you got to see what the woman looked like and sounded like and how resolute she was. She looked like my grandmother, actually, that jaw, you know, I'm not turning back. I'm not doing what you want. I'm sleeping with who I want.
She was great.
She was great. And
one of the interesting things that came out of our relationship with these old anarchists, at that point, they were the old anarchists. Now, I guess we are. But when they were closing down the newspaper, they found a film can in their archive, which they gave to us. And after screening it, after transferring it, and doing a lot of detective work, it turns out it was a newsreel about the funeral of the Spanish anarchist Buenaventura Durruti, died during the struggle around the Spanish Civil War. And the narrator was Emma Goldman.
Wow.
And it was probably the last print in the world.
Yeah, I should mention that Durruti, who's well-known among anarchists, was a militia leader from Barcelona who basically headed the anti-Franco forces after Franco came in. He basically was well-known. He was a remarkable character. You know, he was a general, but not really a general. I mean, a general who really asked people to if they wanted to fight as opposed to ordering them to fight. So after he died, there was this huge gathering, as Steve said, in Barcelona, tens of thousands of people. And it turned out that the narrator was Emma Goldman, which we learned later.
So you were smart to go on that last day. They might have held on to that can of film.
Well, we had been waiting, for the invitation. So,
should I remind anybody that this is WBAI? I'm Janet Coleman. This is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm here with Steve Fischler and Joe Suter talking about their films on American radicalism that have been recently re-released. And I guess they've spruced them all up, sound and film and everything, to stream. You can reach these films at ovid.tv, and I highly recommend them. These aren't the only filmmakers, but I have to say they're collection is extraordinary. Let's talk, we'll play another tune in a little while out of sync with our narrative here, but I do want to talk about the very unusual film From Swastika to Jim Crow. I mean, it's a documentary area I've never seen before. It was a piece of cultural history that would be banned in Florida. And it talks about the emigre professors who escaped Nazi Germany and were hired, could only really find work in black colleges, in historical black colleges and universities, because those were the only ones willing to take Jews. That is came a little much later, I think, in your career. But what created the motivated you to grab this topic and lay it out there in film forever?
I think that we do grab on to unusual subjects for a variety of reasons, personal experiences, you know, martial arts, stuff like that. But in this case, it was really a kind of situation where I was in Florida on vacation, and I looked at a newspaper. I saw this letter to the editor from a guy named John Hurst. This is about the time when Khalid Mohammed was giving anti-Semitic speeches at Howard University. So this professor said, listen, I know this is going on, but I remember a time when everybody got along at Howard University. I taught there. He went on to say that a lot of the information can be found in a book called From Swastika to Jim Crow. Mm. by an author, Gabriel Edgecombe. So as soon as I saw that, I said to Steve, oh, man, this is really interesting. Let's get the book. And we got the book. Gabrielle was still alive. She was a German refugee herself, but who had been involved with the civil rights movement when she had gotten over here with her husband, and she became interested in this subject. And she was the inspiration to make, you know, for making this film.
Wow. And you've dedicated to the film to her, right?
Oh, yeah.
We worked very closely with her. She was a great, she was just a great person, really smart. She was the first person to notice the phenomena of Jewish refugee scholars at black colleges. They were all over the place. But, you know, we're talking the 1930s and 1940s. There was no Facebook group. It's refugee scholars at black colleges.
Right.
They didn't self-identify as a group, but she observed that, and she did a book, which was really kind of a collection of some oral history interviews with different students and professors. We used her research and some of her contacts to begin making the film. We were lucky enough to actually film some of these scholars. Others whose stories we tell in the film had already died, but we were able to, to recreate a bit of their life included in the film.
And their students as well, extraordinary.
Their students,
students who were very young.
So much of the film is about the relationship between these professors and their students and how deep and significant they were. And I just think that's, you know, kind of incredible.
Incredible. I mean, it's interesting because you do show a picture of an old photo of Einstein coming. Maybe it's old movie footage, newsreel footage of Einstein coming to the United States and being, I guess, ushered over to Princeton. These guys couldn't get work at Princeton unless they were Einstein. They really were rebuffed. And
right, because they were younger scholars. The people
they
in the film,
right.
They were
That's
in their
true.
Late 20s or early 30s.
When
they weren't Hannah Arendt. They weren't, you know, Albert Einstein, who the big universities wanted to grab up. So they were beginning their careers, and it was a kind of a two-way street. Their lives were rescued in a way by getting teaching positions at black colleges, and black colleges benefited because they were getting world-class scholars. And they were paying them $1,500 a year in salary or something like that. So this was a kind of symbiotic relationship that worked both for the scholars, the refugee scholars, as well as for the communities at these HBCUs.
Right. And they had there's a section there on Emmett Till because this was happening during most of their 10 years. And, you know, brutality in the South was no big surprise. Going into a strange neighborhood and whistling was not a good idea. And they all knew it. The Jewish professors and their families knew it. And all of the black students knew that they were tippy-toeing around these rules of segregation. They were off the books. They were all the Red Squad, weren't they? Everybody in the town was a Red Squad person.
They basically had something in Mississippi called the Sovereignty Commission. And the idea of the Sovereignty Commission was to maintain surveillance on people they would call race agitators. Professor Barinsky, one of the professors we cover in the film, was, and we have even have documents, race agitator. So,
And
what I think is interesting about the film is it is evergreen in terms of its kind of focusing on the issue of both anti-Semitism and racism.
Still
around with us today.
Still alive and kicking us.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Gabrielle Edgecombe wrote the book we were just talking about. In the film, she describes the refugee scholars as having a double exile experience. They were exiled, they were thrown out of Germany by the Nazis in the 1930s. Then when they get positions at black colleges, they're kind of exiled from the white communities there because the white community looked at these scholars with a lot of suspicion.
Right. They spoke this accent. They looked funny. They were small.
And they were working with African Americans, which was, kind of a no-no in the Jim Crow South.
And what they were teaching was even more disturbing to the natives of Mississippi or Alabama, wherever they were teaching. They were really learning to understand each other's servitude or low place. And so that was the part of it that really was amazing, how these young Black scholars either grew into great scholars, all remembering exactly the kind of education that they'd received that they could never have without the, you know, the support of their professors, such close relationships. Anyway, let's listen, because we didn't, when you talked about the Spanish Civil War, we didn't hear the songs. Let's hear the song before we have to go. And reminding you again, this is WBAI, Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman, and here with Steve Fischler and Joel Sucher about their great collection of anarchist films and socially responsible and basically just a unique collection that is available to you through Ovid.tv. So this is called the Through the Barricades, it is. And this is the anthem of the Spanish Civil War. And we can go back to that.
The anarchists in the Spanish Civil War.
The anarchists. That's a very different thing, right? We'll talk about how hard it was to fight as an anarchist in the Spanish Civil War. Here it is, To the Barricades. Where did you find this? Is from Anarchism in America? No, this is from the discussion of how anarchism really was a transplant from all of these various groups of emigres from other countries, and in Spain it was pretty well developed.
Well, in Spain, basically,
by the time of the Spanish Civil War,
the anarchists were really poised to fight the 1936, incursion by Franco and his fascist forces. They were pretty well organized. And Spain happened to have been one of the few places where anarchism was really put into action. I mean, George Orwell in Almost Catalonia discusses exactly what it was like, where there was no servitude. People would address each other as equals. This went on for a year and a half before the internal problems between the anarchists, well, should we stay, purely anarchist? Should we join the government, in Madrid fighting the incursion of Franco and his German and Italian allies? Mm. That kind of was one of those kind of fights that pretty much.
Really what happened in Spain, there was a social revolution that was spearheaded certainly in part by the anarchists, and the Spanish Civil War was really a counter-revolution started by the fascist under Franco to kind of suppress that.
Right.
So, that's sort of the chronology and the context for it.
Go ahead. I'm so sorry.
One thing I should add, that the experience of the Spanish Civil War has been replayed not so long ago, and that is with the Rojavan in Rojava, where the YPK, which are the Kurdish anarchists, have actually been fighting on the front lines against the Al-Qaeda types.
Right.
And in fact, in a kind of weird irony, they've been, spearheading fights with American Special Forces. And in fact, American Special Forces saying these people are great. Their militias are made up of women led militias. And this is ongoing. And it's, again, something you don't hear about, except when you hear Erdogan in Turkey start complaining about, you know, getting a hold on these Kurdish terrorists, as he says.
This is Ahmet Erdogan of Atlantic Records. Who's an anarchist.
That was Mr. Turkish Mr. Erdogan.
Turkish Erdogan. Oh, his father or him, or when he was in Turkey?
No idea.
I think he was bi-coastal. Well, we are kind of running short on time, unbelievably. I do want to mention this film, the short film, and you made it early on, I think, 1974, Frame Up, The Imprisonment of Martin Sostre. These films are so pertinent now and not so different from what you might be if your hair you had, I don't know, more curly hair, you might be out in the streets doing yourself. But what are you making? Are you working on any of this stuff we see now? I mean, this George Santos guy is a perfect subject for you. I mean, it's too late now.
He's the politician that America deserves.
But it's one of the kind of films that you might have really unearthed. That's something true. So low and so, you know, disgusting that nobody ever heard of before, but here we have it. Anything you'd like to cover?
Well, we are working on a few things. We're doing some Scorsese related stuff because we have a long history. You know, we've got a couple of other projects basically, you know, growing out of stuff we did in the past and which we could never find money for, because that's one of the things you could never find money for is documentaries.
Right.
But yeah, you know, some of it's on our website, I think.
We're continuing our research. We have some projects that deal with surveillance and civil liberties, sort of an extension of Red Squad, some of the ideas and issues that began our career.
Yeah.
That's something that we've continued with and we're still interested in.
Well, they have certainly resurfaced in a big, big way. I mean, what do you make of it personally that everything goes around and comes around in this awful way, not the way that most of those beautiful, sweet anarchists might have predicted?
Well, what can you do? I mean, I got two kids. Steve's got a kid. And, you know, you just tell them, listen, you got to keep up the struggle. You know, right. His daughter's a journalist. My two kids are lawyers, but they know about this stuff. So,
yeah. And do they admire your work? Are they scholars of your work?
No,
they better.
I hope so. Anyway, I believe they do. I'm not
going to say. Yeah,
100 films. That's a lot of films.
Yes, and a fairly, if you go through the whole list, a fairly eclectic. Group of subjects. Of course, there's a kind of a political consciousness that runs through it because of who we are. But
not really. I mean, what's the political context of martial arts?
Fighting.
Well, that was just, you know, that's just an area that we're interested in. And
in real life.
We had a lot of fun. So.
We have exactly 1 minute left to go, and I do want to tell everybody to check out OVID.TV, the movie called Frame Up, The Imprisonment of Martin Sostre. A black guy opens a bookstore in Buffalo and
gets framed by the police.
And in fact, I should mention Frank Donner, the labor lawyer, actually was the guy who turned us on to that story.
What a story. And, you know, Buffalo, who knows about it?
Well,
Buffalo returns.
The film was part and parcel of a movement for Sostre, which ultimately was successful because he got executive clemency for, I think it was Hugh Carey, was governor of New York, because otherwise he would have spent the rest of his life in jail.
And I should mention in closing that he was probably the first of the jailhouse lawyers, successful jailhouse lawyers. He wrote all his briefs longhand, and he was successful with a few of them.
Which one is this, Frank or
Martin Sostre?
Oh,
and he was an anarchist.
And he's great.
He's an anarchist, right?
And he's a movie star.
Oh, he's dead now. So.
Well, sorry about that. Really,
anyway.
So you have been listening to Cat Radio Cafe, heard Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on WBAI. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are...
David Dozer.
For This Place Playwright. You can reach us at catradiocafe@gmail.com, and you can make a tax-deductible pledge in any amount to WBAI by calling 212-209-2950.
Or online at give2wbai.org.
With special thanks to Bob Ald. On tonight's show, we were joined by filmmakers Stephen Fischler and Joel Sucher to discuss five of their films on American radicalism, including From Swastika to Jim Crow and Red Squad, among the latest streaming releases from Ovid's collection. Anarchy, the collection is called Anarchy in the USA, and we'll be having more of the filmmakers on in a couple of weeks. So, in the meantime, Ovid.tv, and see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Through the windows of cars.
Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil
of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Same great soulful sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio.
Sweet Tuesday, darling Tuesday. Everything is Tuesday, Tuesday, Tuesday.
We're raising money today for the tower fund here at WBAI.
And without that tower, we can't stay on the air.
Please, just give what you can.
And those contributions can be small or they can be large, but those are the contributions that we need to make in order to beat back the other side. No one is going to do it for us.
Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
Let's face it, without Pacifica, what do you have? NPR is too milquetoast. PBS, too milquetoast. Without Pacifica, we're dead in the water.
And that pledge line is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950.
And we're only asking those who can give it, those who can afford it. We know that there's some people out there who cannot afford it, and that's one of the problems. Those of us who relatively have must stand up for those who have not.
I'm sick and tired hearing people complain about, well, you know, the right wing has Fox News and they have this and they have that. The oppressor always has more money than the oppressed. We have to make use of the resources that we have. We have people, and we have people that can make contributions.
Here on WBAI 99.5 FM, we want to have the tower fund strong and healthy so we're not worried about it.
212-209-2950.
Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the tower fund.
You remember the buddy system. Every summer field trip. Every time you jumped into the deep end. Every time you got on a roller coaster. You buddied up. And though that may all seem like 100 summers ago, wouldn't it be nice to have that feeling of buddying up one more time? Visit give2wbai.org to learn how to become a BAI buddy. By making a monthly commitment of any amount, you'll help WBAI to continue to provide the groundbreaking programming that you love. You'll also get exclusive perks as our way of saying thanks, because life is always better with a buddy.
This is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Extinction Diaries. Tropical waters at the equator are known to be the richest and most stable diversity in the oceans. However, a research study released in spring of 2021 has concluded that the data indicates that stability and diversity has changed. There is an increasing exodus of marine life fleeing the equator. In fact, the equator is no longer the dominant bulk of diversity. Fossil records indicate that species flee for cooler waters. Many, if not most, species will disappear. Scientists warn that a similar warming as we are seeing today occurred some 250 million years ago, and over 90% of marine life died. Of course, this means dire consequences for humans that include harvesting food and tourism. Entire nations depending on fishing and tourism will find themselves without. There has never been a clear reason to protect and conserve marine areas and to ensure as much life as possible enter into the migrations that can no longer be averted. 5 years ago, scientists warned ocean warming could